The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
What we need to realize is that if China continues on its path of growth and its trajectory of development, it is going to become a competitor unlike anything the United States has faced since arguably the 19th century, which is more than a great power, but a peer, far, far more powerful than the Soviet Union ever was, you know, at the peak of its power. And I think the conclusion that I take from that is, you know, look, China could fall flat on its face tomorrow. I mean, anything could happen, but in the event that that doesn't, and we can't plan under the assumption that it won't, we are going to have to redefine some of the objectives that we've had for the past 30 years as far as the endurance of U.S. global military primacy.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 6th, 2020. Christian Broz was the staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He was also John McCain's senior policy advisor. He now works as the chief strategy officer of Anduril Industries, and he is the author of The Kill Chain, Defending America in the Future of High-Tech Warfare. It's a fascinating look at how far behind the United States is growing in possible conflict against its principal national security adversary, China. I sat down with Chris in the virtual jungle studio to talk it all through. What would happen if China and the United States actually fought a war? How has China modernized its military so quickly without the kind of military spending the U.S. has engaged in? And what does the United States need to do to stay current? It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 6th. Happy 4th, everybody. Chris Broz on The Kill Chain. Chris, I want to start at the point at which you start the book, which is in your last meeting with John McCain before he left Washington and then passed away. You had a conversation on a topic that I suspect will surprise a lot of listeners, what you guys spent the evening talking about. Tell us the story.
Yeah, so we had just come out of a briefing that he had asked me to organize for really all of his colleagues in the Senate. And this was, you know, this was a culmination of a lot of work we had been doing to sort of draw attention to the biggest concern that we had that had really motivated, you know, years of work that we did together on the Senate Armed Services Committee, which had to do with America's eroding military technological advantage and the concern that we had that China in particular was just rapidly closing the gap against the United States. And closing the gap not because they were playing the same game we were, but because they were playing a very different game and had been at it methodically for the better part of, you know, 25, 30 years. So the briefing was really set up to try to give members of the Senate an opportunity to just better understand, you know, what this order of battle looked like, what the Chinese military capabilities looked like that they have been systematically developing and fielding, and developing and fielding to specifically call into question and sort of undermine the way the United States has been building military forces and planning to use them. So, you know, the briefing was a wake-up call. You know, we had organized for the entire Senate. We ended up only getting about a dozen or so members. And the briefing was quite a wake-up call as far as, you know, what this problem looks like, what the Chinese military has been building, how it kind of matches up against, you know, how the United States is planning to approach that problem. And it led to a conversation that he and I had sort of afterwards, just sort of thinking through, look, God forbid we end up in a situation by, you know, accident, by happenstance, by, you know, kind of bad choices on both sides. We end up in a situation where the United States is actually in a war with China. How would that go? And we sort of spent, you know, a fair bit of that evening kind of imagining how this would play out. And, you know, I think for both of us, the situation is pretty dire and the outcome would be pretty bad. We can talk through sort of the details of exactly sort of how we saw that going, kind of what we saw as the biggest problems as far as what the Chinese military is bringing to bear and how they're planning to kind of contest the United States. And ultimately, you know, I think the conclusion was this would not be a successful outcome for the United States. It would end badly. And, you know, I think for many people in the Department of Defense, you know, this is something that they've become increasingly aware of in recent years. But I think for many members of Congress and certainly for kind of the American public at large, this is not something that they're aware of at all. They're not aware of how much progress the Chinese military has made, and I think the sort of precarious position that the United States finds itself in.
Let's go through that exercise and walk through that a little bit. The assumption that you write about, or that's implicit in when you discuss this in the book, is that this would be a naval confrontation of some kind, and that, you know, this is a classic sort of U.S. in Asia situation where the U.S. has to project force halfway around the world and the Chinese have to establish that the U.S. doesn't get to project force in their territorial seas or in the Western Pacific. So what does it look like? There's a big set of misunderstandings in the South China Sea or in the one of the other contested naval regions. And for reasons that are, we don't have to go into, it comes to blows. How does it go?
So, you know, what we sort of imagined that evening, and certainly what I've spent a lot of time thinking about, is the way in which, you know, China has been building its military for 25 years to systematically target the ways that America projects power, builds its force. And all of those advantages that we've thought we've had would sort of systematically come under attack. So the sort of infrastructure through which America projects power, all of our forward bases would be immediately susceptible to long-range ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, potentially hypersonic weapons, larger quantities than these bases have the ability to defend themselves against.
And just to be clear, our forward bases there are Guam.
Japan, you know, kind of that warfighting infrastructure that we have relied upon since World War II. And these are fixed sites. They're not moving. The Chinese know where they are. They know how to find them. And large quantities of weapons would be headed in the direction of those locations in the event of a conflict. Again, the strategy being just inundate these locations, these critical locations, with large quantities of weapons. The mass movement of U.S. military power across the Pacific Ocean that you talked about, that is going to become contested at every step of the way, you know, from cyber attacks in the American homeland to, you know, additional attacks, whether they're cyber, whether they're communications disruptions, whether they're actual kinetic attacks, you know, as that force begins to project itself from the continental United States to the Western Pacific. All of, you know, the primarily kind of maritime movement of aircraft carriers, the carrier battle group, these are forces that, you know, the Chinese military has been building over the horizon radars and long-range reconnaissance satellites and other sensors to detect the movement of these kind of critical warfighting assets across that large transit. And then similarly, try to inundate them with anti-ship ballistic missiles and anti-ship cruise missiles. And again, hypersonic missiles as those become more developed. The communications and information networks and command and control through which, you know, U.S. forces, you know, kind of rely to fight are going to become susceptible to, or are susceptible, would, you know, would immediately face significant amounts of jamming, sort of information attacks, cyber attacks, anti-satellite weapons to, you know, to target U.S. satellites on orbit. All of the force that would be seeking to be projected, you know, much of it from the air, whether those are, you know, strike aircraft flying out of regional bases or strike aircraft coming off the carrier deck. These aircraft are going to have a very difficult time getting through very dense networks of integrated air and missile defense systems that the Chinese have systematically been building and fielding. For the carrier air wing in particular, their challenge is going to be that the carrier has been pushed back so far that the aircraft flying off the deck are now not going to be able to get where they need to go without the assistance of, you know, in-air refueling. Those aircraft or refueling aircraft themselves are largely defenseless. So, you know, they will also then be subjected to attacks that, you know, the Chinese would seek to marshal either in the form of surface-to-air missiles or air-to-air weapons. And, you know, again, this is all around the doctrine that the Chinese have spoken about and written about that they call systems destruction warfare, building and fielding capabilities to sort of rip apart the way American, you know, the U.S. military has been building and operating its battle networks, how it moves information, how it relies on critical intelligence, certainly from space, but also in other domains, how communication and command and control occurs. They have systematically been building these capabilities to deny us those advantages, to disrupt that activity, and ultimately prevent us from being able to project power, fight effectively, and accomplish our objectives. And, you know, all of this, sure, is to some extent theoretical. Like, we you know, this was a conversation that I was having with my late boss, you know, after a briefing one evening. But a lot of what we are talking about has been, you know, thought through, war-gamed, looked at. And again and again and again, you know, the conclusions that people reach are pretty bad. And I think this is something that we need to spend a lot more time addressing.
All right. So I guess before we interrogate whether the situation is quite as bad as you just described, I want to ask you how we got here. The United States spends more money on defense than the next several militaries combined. So how is it that in the face of that level of commitment on the part of the United States, the Chinese have managed to close this awesome pre-existing capabilities gap so effectively that we could even be having this conversation?
So I think there are a lot of answers to that. I think partly it's because, you know, the United States has global commitments. We are focused in a lot of other places in the world with very critical business, not just in the Asia Pacific region. I think part of it is for the past two decades, you know, we've had a lot of work that we've had to do from a counterterrorism standpoint, kind of response to the events, you know, to 9/11, the wars that followed. I think part of it is the way they have been putting this strategy together has been very, very methodical. It has been, you know, making progress piece by piece. You know, we have become the sort of proverbial frog in the pot where little by little, the water temperature has been getting hotter. It's not always noticeable to us, but, you know, as this has played out over the past few decades, the water temperature is now considerably hotter than what it was, you know, 10, 20, 25 years ago. I think part of it is, you know, the way in which they have disrupted us. I think they've disrupted us at the level of strategy in terms of what they have sought to do, how they have sought to build their military. Again, they're doing a lot that sort of looks like traditional power projection, you know, building aircraft carriers, things like that. But a lot of what they have built has been purpose-built to call into question the assumptions on which the U.S. military has been built for a very long time. And I think the nature of disruption is oftentimes very difficult for the disrupted to recognize the extent of the problem that they are facing and sort of marshal the, you know, kind of the will to change. And I think that has been, you know, that has been a considerable part of this story, that we have been doing things the same way for so long. We have relied upon the same kinds of military systems for so long, and we've been dominant for so long, you know, from a global military standpoint, that all of this, I think, has come together to make it more and more difficult for us to accept the realization that the ways in which we have been building a military, the ways in which we've been planning to use it, the competitors that we have been sort of, you know, baselining ourselves against, all of this has become, you know, now I think increasingly overtaken. And, you know, because it's taken us so long to acknowledge this and really, I think, begin to sort of focus on this problem with the kind of, you know, level of effort that is required, you know, we have systematically found ourselves in a pretty dire position. And I would argue that it's really only been in the past few years that, you know, the focus has been put on this problem in the way that I think it deserves. And I would argue that we're still, you know, not fully there in terms of marshaling kind of the national level effort and sort of moving with the sense of urgency that's required to get after this.
All right. So let's talk about the strategic elements of this, because I think that's actually one way to make your points vivid. What is the strategic assumption of U.S. force projection, and what are the cracks in that that the Chinese have seen and sought to build a military capability around exploiting?
Yeah. So I think for the longest time, we've assumed that, certainly since the end of the Cold War, we have assumed that we would be able to fight on timelines of our choosing. So going all the way back to the first Gulf War, you know, Iraq invades Kuwait, and for months and months and months, you know, we systematically build up forces, you know, we, you know, kind of flow forces into the theater. We sort of set that whole thing in motion. And then at a time of our choosing, we decide to, you know, kind of take the initiative. So we've assumed that time is on our side. We have assumed that the opponents that we would be facing, the competitors we would be facing, we would be able to overmatch with superior military technological capabilities. We would be able to evade detection through things like stealth. We would be facing an adversary that didn't really have a lot of ability to, you know, degrade and sort of ultimately contest our sort of movement, physical movement in the world, communications, our ability to sort of shoot at will. That, you know, we have assumed that we would have these sanctuaries from which we could project power, you know, those forward bases where we could, you know, build up forces, where we could refit, rearm, and sort of move forward as we chose. We've largely assumed that we would not lose a lot of forces in combat. We would lose forces, we would lose people, and we have in recent years and decades. But all things being equal, those forces have been, or those losses have been more modest. The, you know, kind of losses that I think that, you know, we would be facing here are not things that we have been planning, as far as bases, ships, aircraft, you know, large capital assets like aircraft carriers. We've assumed that those things are largely going to be able to operate in permissive environments and not, you know, not be really subjected to the kinds of attacks that would threaten their existence. And ultimately, for all of these reasons, for all of these assumptions, you know, we have defined the attributes of our military as increasingly sort of smaller and smaller numbers of, you know, relatively large, very expensive, very exquisite, very heavily manned and very hard to replace military systems.
We build Death Stars.
Well, we build, yeah. I mean, you can call them Death Stars. I mean, they're very hard to replace. You know, if you lose one, it's going to be very difficult to bring another one to bear. And again, we've optimized the force around these attributes because of the assumptions we've made and the assumptions that, you know, we're not going to lose these kinds of systems in combat, and these systems are going to be able to operate in ways that they aren't really going to face, you know, significant contesting degradation or even possibly defeat. And the problem is, you know, that for 25 years or longer, the Chinese military has been building very large quantities of very precise sensors, weapons, certainly missiles, but increasingly, you know, electronic warfare, cyber, other types of capabilities to attack those sort of large systems that we have, as well as the kind of connective tissue that allows them to operate together and fight together as a network. And those, that sort of connective tissue is just as susceptible, if not more, to attack than the systems themselves. you know, the sort of operation centers and data centers and, you know, large satellites and the refueling aircraft and the logistical forces, both air and maritime, that move forces and people into position. All of this is largely defenseless because we have built it with the assumption that it would be operating in sanctuary. It would not be as, you know, it would not be susceptible to attack. And for a long time, you know, we have been fighting wars in other parts of the world where, to a large extent, that's held true. And that's reinforced, I think, the belief that the assumptions were right and the attributes of the force were right. Putting aside ways in which I think even the opponents we've been facing in places like Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan have found ways, clever ways to disrupt, you know, our legacy force as well. You know, I think all of this has not added up to, you know, kind of the belief or the realization that the entire enterprise in which we have been building the U.S. military is increasingly at risk.
What is the history of our stress testing the viability of these giant platforms against the sort of systems that the Chinese have developed to attack them? Obviously, we haven't had a conflict with the Chinese. So how do we know to be as concerned about it as you are, or maybe somebody who is, from your point of view, overconfident would look at it and say, here's why I'm confident that we don't have a problem here. What is the reservoir of data that exists to draw on for how, you know, in a hypothetical actual conflict, these forces and systems that the Chinese have developed to disrupt our way of warfare would actually be or not be effective?
Yeah, so this is the crux of the problem that militaries have. And, you know, this is certainly, I think, the, you know, a major criticism that people could make of what I'm saying, which is, you know, how do we know? And I think the challenge for militaries is the thing that they, you know, build themselves and prepare themselves to do doesn't always happen, you know, and that's a good thing. We don't want to end up in conflict. The challenge is that in the absence of real world, you know, kind of realistic performance, how do you actually accurately assess yourself and how you measure up against potential competitors? You know, businesses have the market, you know, and sports teams have regular gameplay. I mean, every other sort of facet of, you know, economic or, you know, social activity, there's ways of more accurately assessing yourself and how you measure up. So militaries have to do this through wargaming and analysis and, you know, to some extent, you know, real world exercises, experimentation. It doesn't take the place of real world experience, but it is as close as they can get. And, you know, I think what we've seen for, you know, the better part of a decade now is that a lot of those exercises, a lot of those, you know, war games continue to show that these problems exist, that the blue force, you know, that we're operating has a very difficult time achieving its objectives against the red force when we're running these war games or these simulated exercises or activities. But again, you know, it's not perfect. It's not something that anyone can say with certainty is how these things are going to go. In my experience, you know, they raise enough concerns, they sort of call enough things into question. And that experience has been consistent again and again and again to an extent that I think that it should be adding up to the sort of realization that we have a real problem here. And, you know, I think, you know, kind of add to that on the other side, you know, you see a lot of these military systems that the Chinese have been developing, testing. You know, we can ask the question, well, how are we going to know if those systems themselves will be effective? The thing that I, you know, I think what has been humbling to watch is the speed and effectiveness with which they have consistently fielded military capabilities and then better versions of those capabilities on timelines that are more aggressive than what many people in the United States predicted they would be capable of doing. So, you know, for me, it's not to say that it all adds up to, you know, this is certainty and a given outcome, but it's enough, you know, sort of warning signals and red flags that we should be very attentive to and be, I think, a lot more humble about, you know, how things might turn out, how we actually measure up, specifically considering that we have been playing a certain game for a very long period of time. And China has specifically been building a military to call that into question and put us in the position of actually playing a losing game. And you don't win a losing game by doubling down on your strategy. You have to look for different ways of competing, different ways of building forces and operating them. I think that's what the Department of Defense, Congress are now sort of paying more attention to, focused on more, you know, trying to get after. We're starting very late.
What about on the Chinese side? I mean, we have a limited set of data about the Chinese military, because among other things, it is mostly relatively unbattle tested, but they do have these occasional, you know, border flare-ups, for example, recently with India. How are they performing when it actually, you know, when push actually comes to shove?
So I think it's hard to know because, you know, the border flare-ups are, they're kind of modest activities. You know, China has not been engaged in a full-on conflict the way the United States has, albeit, you know, conflicts that are, I would argue, very different than the kinds of, you know, kind of operational problems or scenarios that we would face if we had to, you know, actually fight a war against China or even, you know, even a Russia. So there's the question on the U.S. side of how much of our experience through, you know, combat in Iraq and Afghanistan and the broader Middle East, how much of that experience is sort of relevant and transferable to the problems that we would face in the Western Pacific, for example. But when it comes to, you know, the Chinese military, I think there are a lot of things that the Chinese military are doing that look very similar to things the United States did a long time ago in terms of, you know, reorganizing operational commands, you know, trying to put in place, you know, more doctrine around joint warfighting. There are a lot of forces that they're building for, you know, power projection, blue water navy, amphibious assault vessels, aircraft carriers. How well those systems are actually working, you know, how well they're performing, it's not always clear, you know, from the outside. But, you know, I think when you kind of look at the level of effort across their kind of military industrial complex, when you look at the trajectory that they're on as far as pulling emerging technology and advanced technology from the civilian world, you know, through this doctrine of military-civil fusion to try to accelerate their progress in the military domain. You know, again, I think to me it adds up to a significant concern about how much progress they've been able to make in a very, I would argue, a limited period of time, and then sort of the trajectory that they're on, both in terms of the scale of that sort of military development, as well as the advanced nature of it as far as how they're integrating artificial intelligence or quantum computing or autonomy or other of these, you know, kind of advanced military technologies. At the end of the day, a lot of this is unknowable. And I think that is the thing that I will struggle with, you know, as I, you know, think about this. It's, I think, the problem that, you know, our kind of defense establishment inherently has to struggle with. I would just argue that there are enough data points out there that when you put them all together, they add up to a pretty considerable concern about the trajectory they're on, the progress they've made, and how effective it might actually be in terms of being able to accomplish their goals, by which I mean denying our ability to accomplish our goals.
So what do you do about it? I mean, our project in the hypothetical conflict that you've described is the much more difficult one, right? We have got to defend or project force very far away. They merely have to prevent us from doing that. So we developed really powerful Death Star-like platforms, and they developed a lot of missiles and flying objects to attack Death Stars, most of which are land-based. And as you point out in the book, the missiles are a hell of a lot cheaper than the Death Stars. So what is, with, unless you're prepared to say, okay, well, let's just let them have the Western Pacific, and then if they want to fight, they have to come over here, and then roles are reversed. Assuming you're not going to say that, you have to develop a strategy and a military force posture that lets you be as nimble and as reliant on relatively inexpensive material as they are, while not being so reliant on giant platforms that are extremely powerful but are relatively easy to attack. So how do you do it?
Yeah, so I tend to think that it is, what is required is a pretty broad reimagination of our defense strategy. And when I say strategy, I mean ends, ways, and means. So just kind of going through that in order. From the standpoint of ends or objectives, I think that what we need to realize is that if China continues on its path of growth or its trajectory of development, it is going to become a competitor unlike anything the United States has faced since arguably the 19th century, which is more than a great power, but a peer, far, far more powerful than the Soviet Union ever was, you know, at the peak of its power. And I think the conclusion that I take from that is, you know, look, China could fall flat on its face tomorrow. I mean, anything could happen. But in the event that that doesn't, and we can't plan under the assumption that it won't, we are going to have to redefine some of the objectives that we've had for the past 30 years as far as the endurance of U.S. global military primacy. I think that is coming to an end. So I think that we need to be a bit more modest about what our objectives are, albeit still to your point, not sort of just retreating away from the Western Pacific and kind of bunkering ourselves into the homeland. I would argue that the goal that we need to really kind of organize ourselves around is the denial of military primacy to China, which is sounds similar, but it's actually quite different. I don't think we're going to get the primacy back that we've enjoyed for the past few decades. And, you know, I think the bigger goal right now is ensuring that China doesn't establish, you know, a position of military primacy, certainly in the Western Pacific, the Asia Pacific more broadly, and sort of outward from there. I think that leads to the question of ways or how we think about, you know, at an operational concepts level, the way we use our military. We have built our military to project power. The bad news is that right now it is becoming very difficult to project power. There are technological reasons for that, and certainly that has been the way the Chinese military has been building its force, to make it harder and harder for the United States to project power over these long distances like you talk about. The good news is that if we make different decisions, power projection can become hard for everybody, to include the Chinese. So thinking about what we would want to accomplish, if our goal is to deny them military primacy or dominance, our objective should be preventing them from committing acts of aggression or force projection, you know, power projection beyond their sort of immediate territory, out into parts of the Asia Pacific region, and more broadly, where there are people, places, things, and interests that matter to the United States of America. That is doable. That, to a large extent, looks like taking a page from the Chinese playbook of building military forces around anti-access area denial, preventing them from having the ability to project power at land, at sea, in the air. It's a very different way of operating. It's more defensive in nature. It's more focused on protecting critical things from attack, aggression, coercion, et cetera. But I think that's a more achievable objective. And I think ultimately, then you look at the question of, well, what kind of military do you need to do that? And I would argue it's very, very much the opposite of the one we have, that it's much, much larger numbers of smaller, sort of more cost-effective, cheaper, more expendable or attritable, much more autonomous military systems. So it's really kind of taking advantage of emerging technologies to build, you know, much larger networks of systems that, again, you know, those assumptions that we talked about earlier are going to be the assumptions we'd have to build that force around, that I'm going to lose a lot of these systems in conflict. They are going to have a very difficult time projecting power. They're focusing more on, you know, they're not going to be hiding and evading detection. So rather than trying to do that through, you know, more and more exquisite variations of stealth or the like, the goal should just be to be ubiquitous, you know, to just present the competitor with so many military systems that the problem is now put back on them of how they decide to attack those systems and marshal forces and expend more precious resources to go after larger quantities of cheaper systems. So again, it's a I would argue and do argue in the book, pretty sweeping, I think, reimagination of how we build our military, how we operate it, and ultimately the objectives that we're seeking to accomplish.
All right, let's try to apply that to brass tacks here and imagine how a U.S. military configured that way would handle a problem that our current military is struggling with, which is China's attempts to assert territorial sovereignty over the South China Sea. And, you know, they've been busily building islands and aggressively asserting control. And we periodically sail a big ship or two or three through under the freedom of navigation operations idea that these are international waters and we're allowed to sail through. And they kind of harass the ship as it goes through. And it's this kind of ritual assertion of sovereignty on their part and non-agreement. And everybody agrees that the harassment won't rise to the level of an armed attack. And everybody also agrees that we'll agree to disagree about what everything means. So the Chinese will say that they allowed our ship into their territorial waters, and we will say we had a phone ops operation, right? And so I'm trying to imagine in your military configuration, you know, which is based on the idea of denial of access to area, you know, systems destruction warfare. What are we doing? Are we firing very large numbers of very small, relatively autonomous missiles at these small manufactured islands? Does the phone ops operation basically look the same? How does the Chris Broz version of the military respond to, you know, aggressive kind of belligerent assertions of sovereignty over what the rest of the world considers to be international waters?
Yeah, so I'd say two things. I think the part of the problem that we have, and I think you described the current state very accurately, is that we mistake these freedom of navigation operations or presence operations where we're sort of, you know, moving through an area, showing the flag. We mistake that for a real deterrence. And we have been doing it for so long. It's overt, you know, it takes on this kind of cat and mouse game or this sort of ritual drama that you've described. But for China, I think they just bake it into their calculations of, you know, how we are postured in the region. It becomes something that they factor into the things they would have to do in the event of a conflict. And I don't ultimately think that it's deterring very much. So I think part of the answer to your question is we need to think differently about deterrence. Deterrence is not going to be created because we're not talking about an open conflict here. We're talking about how do we bring military force to bear to prevent the movement or escalation into outright conflict. So from a standpoint of deterrence, I think we are going to have a lot greater effect at creating that psychological effect in the minds of Chinese decision makers, not necessarily by doing the predictable FONOPs and the predictable presence missions on the regular schedules, but bringing military capabilities into the theater, demonstrating them as we choose at very sort of times of our choosing, in very surprising ways, in very real world, clear ways that send a message to China that we understand how they would seek to use military power in conflict. And we have the ability to deny how they would seek to project power, the ways in which they would, you know, kind of move military forces into that particular part of the world, the South China Sea, in the event of a conflict, that we can take those things away from them, whether they're their aircraft, their ships, the information networks that they rely upon to move that information, do targeting, et cetera, that we are systematically, you know, showing or revealing to the Chinese that we have capabilities that should lead them to think twice about whether they actually want to take this into the domain of real military conflict. And I think, you know, what will then inevitably happen below the surface, as it already is, is this competition in the gray zone. You know, the gray zone is, you know, you're not in peace, you're not in war, but you are very much, you know, in a state of military competition with one another. I think part of the challenge we've had is that, you know, as we have been, you know, kind of mistaking freedom of navigation operations or presence missions for real deterrence, the Chinese have systematically been creating facts on the ground, you know, whether there are, you know, actual islands in the South China Sea or whether they're, you know, inroads politically, diplomatically with, you know, our partners or allies in the region. This is making it harder and harder and harder for the United States to achieve our objectives. And I think what we need to do is, you know, bring a lot of these different kinds of forces to bear where, you know, we are going to be capable of showing that, you know, below the level of outright conflict, we can create positions of military advantage for ourselves. We can deny them the ability to operate the way that they would want to, you know, do now or would want to in conflict. And we have creative responses to a lot of these problems, as opposed to, you know, we're either going to do, you know, presence operations on the one hand, or it's World War III on the other. So I think these are the kinds of flexible responses that are better provided by these kinds of lower cost, you know, more attritable, more autonomous systems. You know, they enable a lot greater, sort of greater options for the United States in peacetime, while at the same time being scalable in the event of a conflict, you know, to do the kinds of things that I'm talking about and bear the kinds of losses that I think would inevitably come, you know, if we ended up in that scenario.
The book is The Kill Chain: Defending America in the Future of High-Tech Warfare. Chris Brose is the former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. I have a question for you all. Have you done your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast? Have you rated it? Have you reviewed it? Have you shared it on all the social media platforms that you use? Have you parlayed about it on Parlay? There you go. I mean, you know, it's the social media platform that everyone's talking about now. Have you gotten on Parlay and made sure people are looking at the Lawfare Podcast? Have you bought merch from thelawfarestore.com? You'll want to get the Lawfare whiskey tumblers. You'll want to get the corkscrew. You'll want to get the puzzle and socks. You can never have too many Lawfare socks. Our music is, of course, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.